We're talking about the timeline to close the state's youth prison, Lincoln Hills. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers told the State Journal a week ago that the deadline of mid-2021 is not realistic without a significant boost in funding for the state's juvenile justice system. Do you support the closure of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake? Do you support smaller regional detention facilities? How do you think they will impact juvenile justice in our state? Do you have a son or daughter who is an inmate? How are they doing? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Riley Vedderkind covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. He has been following the developments at the state's juvenile correction facilities. Riley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So Governor Evers told you the 2021 deadline is not feasible. Why is that?
That's correct. Basically, it comes down to the fact that the governor thinks that there isn't enough money in the state budget provided to be able to get it done by mid-2021. He's had concerns about the timeline for this since taking office about a year ago. So lawmakers passed a bill that would overhaul the juvenile justice system in early 2018, and then got to work on trying to figure out what exactly that plan would look like. The original deadline to replace Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons in northern Wisconsin was supposed to happen by January of 2021, but because of the funding allocation, the governor, upon taking office, said that that wasn't likely to happen until at least 2 years, probably after that deadline. That didn't really go over well with the Republicans who control the state's finance committee. There was eventually a compromise, and lawmakers earlier this year, in the summer of this year, as the budget was being deliberated, decided on a bill that would delay the implementation of this juvenile justice overhaul plan for 6 months. But the governor has continuously said that, you know, we don't think that this is a feasible timeline. We're going to do our best to try to meet it, but no promises. And that is, again, kind of the governor's message, you know, about a year after taking office now. And, you know, both Republicans and Democrats are kind of seeming to kind of walk back this idea that it could be completed within even 6 months. So everything's kind of up in the air still.
Yeah, would lawmakers have to change or amend this law if they aren't going to make that mid-2021 deadline?
Exactly. So currently there's a mid-2021 deadline, and they're going to continue to work within those constraints. But because it's now unlikely that that's going to happen, I would assume that legislation would need to be passed to extend the deadline. Or, as the governor said, if they want to try to meet that pretty ambitious deadline, they will need to try to find more funding, as much as over $100 million. I think nearly $130 million more in funding to try to complete these centers, which is unlikely to happen, but possible if that deadline is a real goal for people.
We're talking with Riley Vedderkind, who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. We're looking at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and the future of closing those facilities down. Do you support the closure of Lincoln Hills? Do you support smaller regional detention facilities? How do you think they will impact juvenile justice in our state? Join in with your questions, your suggestions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Riley, where does Governor Evers think the funding formula right now for juvenile justice and closing down these facilities, where is it falling short?
So it's falling short in a number of areas, particularly the money set aside for the new state facilities that will replace Lincoln Hills. So under this plan, currently the juvenile defendants that are in state that go to state prisons would be sent to either more severe state facilities that would continue to be operated under this plan, and then for the less severe defendants, they would go to about a handful of county centers, which would be scattered across the state. The idea is that they'd be smaller and close to home. So there's about a $130 million funding gap. I believe the governor, when he passed his state budget, wanted more than $275 million total. But so far, they haven't even come close to that. I think, you know, around $180 million has been put in the budget. So just to give you an idea of that, in the state budget passed in July, about $80 million has been directed to counties for those four smaller facilities for less severe offenders. $47 million roughly has been provided to the state, but only some of that is immediately available for those two state-run centers. One would be located in Milwaukee County, and then one would be located in Outagamie County. And then about, I believe, $59 million has been authorized in borrowing to expand Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. That roughly corresponds to the amount that that the governor had wanted. So that area is seems to be met, at least for now, but all these costs could go up.
The governor has said, though, that funding is sufficient enough at this time to begin drawing down the Lincoln Hills population. What does that drawdown look like?
That's correct. So I believe I'd have to go back and look at the numbers because they fluctuate all the time, but I believe there's about 180 or so inmates, at least that they want to provide capacity for in the future. So the governor, when I spoke to him last week, said there's enough funding to begin a slow drawdown of that population. So that would likely mean that counties would simply, you know, stop sending their inmates to Lincoln Hills and would probably start sending them to their own county facilities. That's actually already happened. There are a number of counties, such as Milwaukee and Racine, because of the alleged abuses at Lincoln Hills, have decided to take matters into their own hands and stop sending as many children to those facilities. The facility has seen a decline in population for more than a decade, and that ended up leading to the closure of at least one other of the state's youth prisons, Ethan Allen. And so they can continue to draw that down. And then the idea, I think, is that some of these county centers, maybe one, maybe a couple, could be opened up. Dane County, for instance, they're asking, for a relatively small amount of money. I think it's around $4 million to renovate an existing facility or at least a building that currently exists in downtown Madison and renovate it for use to put its youth offenders. So the idea is that, slowly but surely you could begin, taking matters, these counties could take matters in their own hands and stop sending kids to Lincoln Hills, but Lincoln Hills would keep operating until everybody had a different place to go.
We're talking with Riley Vetterkind, who covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the plans to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the state's long-troubled juvenile prison, and replacing them with smaller regional facilities. Do you live in Racine or Dane, Milwaukee, or another county that has decided to build a juvenile detention center? What are your thoughts? How do you want to see lawmakers tackling funding for juvenile facilities? Join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Riley Vetterkind right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about the timeline to close Lincoln Hills and ongoing challenges state officials have to overhaul juvenile justice. The state plans to close Lincoln Hills by mid-2021, but it hasn't finalized where inmates will be held at that point. Smaller youth facilities around the state have been the goal, so youth offenders are closer to their families. What legislation regarding incarceration, federal or statewide, do you think is necessary? How do you want to see lawmakers look at funding for these smaller facilities? Should they increase the amount to meet what these counties have requested? Join in with your thoughts, your experiences, 800-642-1234. And Wisconsin State Journal politics reporter Riley Vedderkin stays with us. Let's take a call now. John is joining us from Toma this morning. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about it. I was an inmate. I'm 58 now, but back when I was between 17 and 18, I spent a year there as a juvenile offender. And I think it's a good deterrent because it's exactly like a regular adult prison. And I think that if you break it down into the smaller individual counties, it won't be an effective psychological deterrent, because I think that helped me big time throughout the rest of my life, keeping me walked the line, you know, so to speak.
What was that year like there, John? Can you describe it for us?
Well, when you first get there, you're in solitary for like 2 weeks or something like that, under observation, and then they move you to there's individual buildings.
Mm-hmm. Cottages.
Yeah, cottages, and you're in a group. And then you get moved to one of them, and it's, you know, it's more open community, like a little house, you know, and you're all one individual unit, you know. But yeah, it was okay.
John, thanks so much for your perspective and your firsthand experience there. Riley, you know, the state has tried to phase out pepper spray and dramatically reducing the use of solitary confinement and handcuffs. John, brings back his experience when he was 17 and 18. What do we know about how the youth are treated there?
Yeah, well, of course, there have been a number of issues at these prisons over the past several years, leading to a federal investigation that eventually produced no charges, but also settlements with the state that, because of the alleged mistreatment there, the state has ended up paying, I think it's over $25 million or so dollars. And so under that lawsuit, there's been a court-ordered reporter who would go in, usually about four times a year, I think it's every quarter, to assess the conditions at Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills. And those reports, while kind of pretty troubling at first, have consistently got better over the past year. The number of instances in which strip searches are occurring has declined significantly, as have the rates of the use of pepper spray and solitary confinement, both of which I believe are supposed to be phased out over the next year or two. So conditions there are improving. Staff have reduced the use of pepper spray. I think it was used on youth there about five times in July and once in August, to kind of give an example of how frequently it's occurring. And then I think that the use of solitary confinement situations where it's not absolutely necessary has precipitously declined to almost almost where it's not even occurring, at least according to this report. And so, you know, that's kind of another theme as we're looking at this is, as we're kind of battling over how many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to try to provide a replacement for Lincoln Hills, the facility itself is improving pretty steadily, at least according to these reports. They've dealt with pretty bad vacancy rates among staff, but the governor's administration provided about a $5 per hour increase for most staff members there. And so the vacancy rates have really improved. So we're seeing a lot of improvement. And so that may make it, less attractive to to want to deal with the replacement facilities as quickly as lawmakers otherwise would if Lincoln Hills is seeing these improvements.
We're talking with Riley Vetterkind, a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, who's been covering the developments in our state's juvenile justice system. You can join in. What changes do you want to see to juvenile detention in Wisconsin? How do you want to see lawmakers approach funding for these facilities? What legislation on incarceration do you think is necessary? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Joe now, joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I don't believe for a second that things are improving in Lincoln Hills as much as these reports claim. I think the incidents are just not going. They're not reported as often because they're trying to clean up their image. And there's no crime if there's no witness, right?
So you're concerned, Joe, that some issues within Lincoln Hills are going unreported. And I want to bring up, as Joe makes this point, that in September we saw 26 inmates involved in 5 incidents with guards over 2 days in September, Riley. And this was shortly after the phasing out of pepper spray. You had mentioned, Riley, that there's court-ordered monitors going in and checking out the facility and making reports. Is that enough?
Well, I mean, you could make a case that it certainly isn't enough. I mean, of course, you know, as you were noting, there were a series of disturbances at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake in the fall, you know, I think advocates for youth justice would say that this is a great reason to continue with lessening the number of offenders in these types of facilities and focusing on rehabilitation and in diversion programs that that keep them out of the system in the first place. I think a lot of youth advocates as well would say that more funding is needed to address mental health. I think people would say that not enough is done. These reports are just one snapshot of what's going on at this prison and show some improvement. But again, that can easily spike into a situation that we saw earlier this fall. So, of course, you know, legitimate arguments could be made that not enough is being done.
So what did Governor Evers tell you about his next steps? What options is he considering? What's on the table?
Well, he didn't provide all that much clarity. He said that, you know, what needs to be done is looking at the budget and trying to find places to somehow come up with this funding. He did ask for a lot more money in the state budget, and Republicans didn't give it to him. There's differing arguments for why that is. Robin Voss has said that, you know, rather than complaining about the level of funding in the budget, what needs to be done is try to cut red tape and try to make this process as streamlined as possible. You know, whether that would work has yet to be determined. The governor has said that, you know, possibly delaying other state construction projects could potentially free up some funding. You know, we might in the new year be seeing some revenue projections that might provide more money in the budget than we thought we had. Republicans initially said that they want to provide a tax cut, but I don't think the governor is really interested in doing that. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of deliberations that need to be made, but we could be looking at a bit more funding in the state budget.
Like shifting priorities, additional bonding authority, or changing deadlines for other major state projects? Would that be an option?
Yeah, that's certainly something that the governor mentioned, but nothing has been clear cut, and you know, it's going to take political will to do so. This is an issue politically that you know, was relatively important in 2018, but you know, if we look at the politics of this situation, you know, we're heading into a presidential race where this may not gain as much attention as it did during the gubernatorial race. I think Representative Gordon Hintz said as much in an interview with another publication. He said that, you know, of course something needs to be done on this, but the political consequences of just continuing on the current track, you know, wouldn't be that high. So that is kind of providing another disincentive for acting quickly on this. So, you know, a lot needs to be done, but whether it will happen is unclear at this point.
Riley, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Riley Vitterkin covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's been following the developments at the state's juvenile correction facilities. Coming up, Disney launched its streaming service last month with hundreds of titles from its deep archive that go back decades. Question is, how do we viewers deal with racist or offensive moments in movies like Dumbo or Peter Pan? Have you been offended by or misrepresented in these old Disney films? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll look at Disney Plus after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Disney's new streaming service has put warnings at the beginning of some classic movies indicating that they might include racist or otherwise offensive elements. But the decision to attach a message saying that this film may contain outdated cultural depictions has been met with both praise and concern. So are there Disney movies you loved growing up that you won't show your kids? Which movies did you see with fresh eyes recently that struck you as problematic? Did you choose to get past it, or are you reconsidering what was once a classic in your mind? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robert Thompson is a professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University, and he directs its Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. Bob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So some of these older films, like the Dumbo, like Peter Pan, come with a warning. And this warning says, this program is presented as originally created. It may contain outdated cultural depictions. And some see this warning as really passive. Others see it as progress. Where do you come in?
Well, first of all, you just read the entire warning. That's the whole text. This program is presented, that is passive, as originally created. Nobody says that it's presented as originally created by our company. This is a Disney stuff that we're putting this on. And it may contain outdated cultural depictions. So we can take that apart from the start to finish. Is presented, again, doesn't imply any agency. It's as though somehow this stuff just happened to be on their streaming service. They had nothing to do with it. It may contain outdated cultural depictions. It does contain outdated cultural depictions. There's no question about that. And calling those kinds of things cultural depictions, I guess that's accurate, but it's a pretty quiet way of saying it. Warner Brothers, when they released, started streaming and on DVD, put some of their old cartoons on, which are filled with problematic stuff, had a very more detailed and I think more useful disclaimer at the beginning of their shows.
Yeah, can I read that? While these cartoons do not represent today's society, they are being presented as they were originally created, because to do otherwise would be the same as claiming these prejudices never existed.
Right. And that was, you're right, that's the Warner Brothers one. However, there was stuff before that. They may depict, again, we've got that may problem, some of the ethnic and racial prejudices that were commonplace in American society. And then they say these depictions were wrong then, and they are wrong today. And I think that was the important part of the Warner Brothers disclaimer, which is, you know, Disney's is implying that somehow all of this was fine when it happened. We live in a different time, and we have to warn you because these were made a long time ago. Warner's comes out and claims that they weren't right when they were made. We've become more conscious. We've grown up to realize that. And I think that's a much more important thing to put on a disclaimer than than what Disney didn't put on theirs.
What do you feel about that word may? Like leaving the door open that, you know, this film to you may be perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, it's perfectly fine is one thing, because for many people, these kinds of things are perfectly fine. For others, they are very much not perfectly fine. So that, the disclaimer one way or the other, isn't going to be able to address personal taste. However, what both Warner Brothers and Disney is claiming is that they may depict some prejudices in the case of Warner Brothers things and culturally outdated stuff in the case of Disney's. There, the may is incorrect. I think it is they do depict. It's like walking out of the door in a thunderstorm and saying you may get wet. You are going to get wet, and they do portray these things. Whether or not that's going to bother the people watching it, that's a matter of their own personal biographies, I guess.
So do you know, is this a blanket statement on all of these older films, or are they picking and choosing here, Disney?
I think they're only putting them on films which have content that clearly are problematic. That's a good question, though. I haven't looked at one that doesn't have anything. I don't know if they're putting it on everything made before a certain date. But I don't think that is true, because we should have another conversation about how this is not something that had just has to do with programming made in the 1940s and 30s and that kind of thing. There are many, many shows, Seinfeld, Friends, How I Met Your Mother, programs that were made which have episodes, you know, as recent as 5 years ago, even more recently, that have got all kinds of problems as well. I was watching an old Seinfeld the other day, and one of Seinfeld's dates has this incredible toy collection, but she keeps them all in their boxes. He wants to play with them, so he goes over to her house, and he drugs her with a sleeping pill, so she falls asleep and he can play with her toys. I mean, that's pretty disturbing. The Yellow Face episode that How I Met Your Mother did, all that It's Pat stuff from Saturday Night Live. So we think that this stuff is only going on and problematic in, you know, Dumbo, made in the 1940s. I think we should probably have warnings on some stuff that was made a lot later than that.
We're talking with Bob Thompson. He teaches mass communications and media studies at Syracuse University. You can join in on this topic. Are children too young to connect the dots on some of the problematic messaging you notice now as an adult? Do you think there's a way to consume these films in a responsible way, or do you think they should be removed from Disney's streaming service altogether? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bob, you bring the contemporary issues to the forefront here, but let's look at some of these old films, starting with Dumbo. What are the problems in this film?
Well, one of the big problems in the film is there's a bunch of birds singing, and there's a blackbird, and his name is Jim Crow. And, of course, that's a joke, a verbal joke made on Jim Crow laws and all of that kind of thing. I will say right off the bat that I am very much against the idea of making these things go away. And apparently Disney has got some kind of line for that, because Song of the South, in fact, has been out of circulation for a long, long time. I think probably over three decades. So it's interesting how, you know, Song of the South is too bad to play, but the other ones aren't. Now,
because
I agree
it's...
that Song of the South is really problematic, but I don't think we should make these go away any more than I think we should take out of history textbooks really bad things that we as human beings have done. On the other hand, I think these warnings do or can, if they were worded right, make the acknowledgement where one takes responsibility for the fact that these companies made these things, but to acknowledge that we have made some progress since.
So Song of the South, going back to that, it was taken out of Disney's streaming service. It criticizes or minimizes slavery. What are the issues with this particular film?
Well, it's a part of that whole, and most of the 50 years that minstrelsy was the major form of American entertainment, presents this idea in an entertainment format that life down in Dixie was wonderful, carry me back to old Virginia, and that those days of slavery were days of warmth and family and all of that kind of thing. And we have that presentation certainly felt in Song of the South as well. You ask an interesting question, though, about are kids old enough to get all of this? Certainly that Jim Crow thing would be a great way to teach a kid what Jim Crow actually means. I don't know if you're a three-year-old or a four-year-old watching a show about an elephant with big ears, whether or not that's going to actually register. I think that's a decision that individual parents are going to have to make. On the other hand, I think to sit your kids in front of old Tom and Jerry movies or some of these kind of egregiously problematic programs that that Disney have without giving them any kind of context, I think would be a problem in and of itself. And you can't expect a little kid to read a disclaimer. And even if they do read a disclaimer, those disclaimers, as we pointed out, are pretty much without teeth.
Well, let's get some context around Peter Pan. What is problematic with Peter Pan?
Well, there's, of course, the presentation of the Native Americans on Peter Pan, which are done in the standard stereotype of, if you're of a certain age, as I am, American popular culture, were things we saw all the time. The typical Native American with the feathered headdress and all of the rest of it, and the way the white characters appropriate the headdresses and the Native dress and all the rest of it. And there's a song, What Made the Red Man Red, which we could spend the rest of the time going through the lyrics of that one.
Disney has fielded criticism in recent years of how the portrayal of princesses needing to be rescued is handled. What do you see as issues in the way women are portrayed in these films?
Well, certainly. I mean, there have been dissertations and books and entire careers built on assessing this idea of the Disney princess, which, of course, as these other things we've been talking about, are manifest station in Disney films of things that were all over the culture in those times. Clearly, if you look at the evolution of the Disney princess as Disney went along, it has made, I don't know if I'd use the word progress, but it has changed as a response to those kinds of issues. I think there's still all kinds of problems with the presentation of the princess. Just like a comparison I would make with Miss America, which just aired last week or the week before. Miss America has done a million things to try to update its idea of gender and women and all the rest of it, but it's still Miss America. They still put a crown and you wear a sash and all the rest of it. The whole idea of princess movies are fraught with all kinds of issues. I don't think Disney is going to make a animated feature about Princess Diana anytime in the near future. And that's, of course, a modern American princess.
Bob Thompson teaches mass communications and media studies at Syracuse. We're looking at racial overtones in films. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Walt Disney's new streaming service and what to do about classic films with outdated cultural references and racist overtones. It's a conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Reaction to Disney's content warning has been mixed. Some media observers praise the fact that Disney mostly did not keep racist movies off the streaming service or change them to remove the criticized elements. Others felt Disney was not direct about what the content warning actually refers to. Disney chose vague language, wasn't explicit about its intended message. What do you think? Where do you fall? Do you subscribe to Disney Plus? Are you watching these classic films that have, you know, issues, themes? How do you handle them? We're at 800-642-1234. Bob Thompson stays with us. He directs the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Bob, Walt Disney, who co-founded the Walt Disney Company with his brother, Roy, Walt Disney has been called racist. He's been called misogynistic, although his biographer and other supporters have disputed that representation. Do we need to stop and think about tracing some of this to the origin, the founder himself?
Yeah, well, that is a really difficult question. The whole, you know, what happens when bad people make good art? And I think first of all, I would start again with the whole thing we talk about with these culture, with these announcements, is that you don't make the material go away. That, I think, is never a good idea of pretending that it didn't exist. We have the same issue in a more extreme case, I guess, would be with Bill Cosby. What we have found out about Bill Cosby, the human being, what he is serving time for doing, of course, is reprehensible. At the same time, we cannot make go away the important things he did in the history of American television, which was really, really significant in a number of different kinds of programming. So I think, yes, if one's going to look at this in a big culture, in the larger context, Disney and what Disney stood for and what Disney thought and what he put into his company is important. At the same time, I don't really know what we do with that information, except bring it as a whole approach to the text, to the film.
We have an email here from Paul in Eau Claire, who routinely uses Disney Plus for teaching moments with daughters. Just last week, Paul said he watched Pocahontas, paused to explain the propaganda elements that are anti-European. So Paul is watching and explaining at the same time.
Right. And explaining from the sounds of it from a different perspective than a lot of people complain about Pocahontas. He sounds like he's using it as a teaching moment for Pocahontas's anti-European messages, yeah, as opposed to its portrayal of Native Americans. And Pocahontas is a very complex film. You can look at that from all kinds of different ways in which it's doing representation, not to mention its fact of playing pretty fast and loose with the historical record.
Talking with Bob Thompson, media scholar at Syracuse, we're talking about outdated and racist references in Disney's archive. Bob, do the conversations we're having about these films now have you feeling a bit more optimistic and about how conscientious we are about the past and present damage that they do?
Well, I am. I mean, I think the very fact that we feel the need to, and I think most people, thinking people do, to label these things as, okay, look, you're not just falling on something that was made yesterday, here's the cultural context, implies that, in fact, we are more sensitive about these things, that we are not making the kinds of cartoons that Tom and Jerry was making many decades ago, or we're not making the kinds of things that we see in Dumbo and Peter Pan. And I think that's a good thing. One of the first movies you ever watch in a history of movies course is D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. Mm. That movie ends with the heroes riding in like the cavalry to save the day, but the heroes are the KKK, literally the KKK. That movie ends with a vision of Jesus Christ happy that order has been put in the Reconstruction era South so that people of color cannot vote. That's really how that movie ends. We've certainly gone a long way since then. So the very fact that we're having this conversation, I think, there is some optimistic way to approach it, because we are thinking, I think, a little more humanely about these things.
Do you think that there are conversations inside these big media companies about what to do with their deep archives and how do they recycle them? I mean, there is money to be made by putting these films out there, and yet they also have to reconcile where we are as a society.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, once again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I don't think we want to take these things away. I think they're important, part of the historical record. But at the same time, I think some acknowledgement has to be made. And I think these messages at the beginning are not a bad way of doing it. I think they should just be a bit more careful as to how they word them, take the responsibility, and then go ahead and do it. I mean, so much of comedy in the history, especially of American popular culture, was based on racial jokes, of vaudeville. People specialized in all kinds of stereotypes. We have to see that as part of our history, but also see that it wasn't just, oh, those crazy people from the, you know, 1880s, that those kinds of portrayals had very real impact on our society and in some very negative kinds of ways.
Is there a responsible way then for parents to allow their kids to watch these films, or should they, you know, try to address them in some way?
Boy, I don't know. I don't know that I'm smart enough to answer that question. I suppose that for the very young, everything you put in front of the very young, good parenting would require you to be doing a constant running commentary of it. But for one thing, most parents do not have the time to do that. They're putting food on the table and a roof over the head of those kids. And secondly, most kids would not want to watch anything if mom and dad were giving a seminar while they were watching it. So it's a tough question. I mean, you don't, if a kid were simply to sit down and all day watch Disney stuff that was made before 1950, I think that would be a problem. That would be the same kind of cultural, I don't hesitate to use the word indoctrination, but that people had when they were originally watched. I suppose part of it is that most people are diversifying their portfolio of culture. They're watching contemporary stuff and they're watching other kinds of things. And they may even hopefully be hearing conversations about this sort of thing. So I don't know. Yes, in the best of possible worlds, all of these things would be filled with teaching and learning and all the rest of it. But we obviously don't live in that world.
In the last minute we have with you, it's been about a month now since Disney Plus has offered their streaming service. This is a really, really deep archive. Disney's been making movies for a better part of a century. What are you seeing with this offering?
Well, you're right. They've got a content that goes back to the 1920s. They've got the Disney Channel. They've got Disney. They've got the Simpsons. They've got Marvel and all the rest of it. And they are not going to quit. They're not going to take away big chunks of that. Disney's launch has been pretty successful, though they had some ugly first days. But in the end, I think it's good that we now have easy access to the entire run of a company that was very important to framing the consciousness of an entire country for nearly a century. Now you can pay $6.99 a month and you can go look at that whole history of what exactly they were saying when they were shaping our consciousness. And I guess you can draw your own conclusions.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always so much of a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bob Thompson teaches mass communications and media studies at Syracuse University. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. Just ahead, we look at President Trump's impeachment inquiry and the trial ahead in the Senate. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.